Hey, what's up, everybody? Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Here we are, Monday, February 3rd. You know what that means? It means that I am 54 years old today. Yes, February 3rd, the day the music died. That is my birthday today. And I am very, very lucky to be here, alive and happy, enjoying life, trying to stay healthy. 2019 was a rough year health-wise with the neck shit going on and everything. But I push on. I'm 54 today, and as of February 1st, I finally got health care. Holy shit, 2020 is working so far. Thrash January happened. I interviewed some of the greatest names in thrash metal. Wow, that was an epic organic thing that happened on this show, and I'm so glad you guys love it. Welcome aboard today, and I'm just kind of reeling in from the incredible 4-day road trip that I just did with Mark Maron, who I cannot thank enough for basically just being a fantastic friend. That's all I need to say about that man. He is just a gem of a human and a perfect friend to have at this point in my life, or at any point in my life, really. But right now, I think that man understands me as much as I understand him. Both never had kids. He's been married, of course, a few times, but I haven't. But we're both single with no kids at this mid-50s point in our life. But very, very happy at what we're doing. He, you know, he's very successful. I am out here struggling, but very, very happy. So it was great to just be out. We did it before out in Texas, and now we're on this full kind of East Coast run of a tour. We're just in Cleveland, Grand Rapids. That's not East Coast. We're about to hit East Coast. I don't know. I'm all blurry today because we were just, we landed, got in cars, did shows, got in cars, drove 4 or 5 hours, did shows, got in cars again, drove 4 or 5 hours, and then came home, watched the Super Bowl, and boom, here we are. I don't know. I want to thank Mark for just being a great, great friend and a mentor, an absolute crushing mentor for me, and just learning the skills of comedy. And by the way, we did do a podcast in his car, or the rental car, and that'll be coming out pretty soon. Let's get into who the guest is today. You want to talk about legend, you can throw that around. I do call a lot of people legends because if they're on this show, a lot of them are legends. They are people that inspired me, that influenced me, that absolutely made me feel happy. And a lot of them have blown my mind. This guy right here today, Robbie Krieger, Hall of Famer, guitar player, songwriter of The Doors. Are you kidding me? Look at this guy, this guest today, Robbie Krieger. I can't even tell you what it felt like to interview this guy. I did it right on the stage at the Whiskey A Go-Go, right where that band got their record deal from Elektra back in the 60s. And it was magic to be in there and just talk to a man who sat on that stage and blew people's minds along with Ray, John, and Jim. That had to be just so incredible to see The Doors back then. That is a band I obviously never saw. And wow, I ran down a rabbit hole of the Doors many, many years ago, and it grabbed me like a drug, and I've been in love with the Doors ever since. Once again, another band I could not stand growing up, had no idea what I was missing out on. I just did not have the depth for a band like the Doors. I didn't understand the sound. What's this keyboard circus stuff? What's going on? And then one day, I was asked to be an extra in the Doors movie many, many, many years ago. And it's funny to think sitting on the set of Oliver Stone's film is where I finally understood the Doors. And it wasn't even them. But the way that the vibe of what was going on while they're filming that, I got it. I was like, oh, I kind of get it. It's an honor to have Robbie on, and he's 74 years old. This guy is still out there playing and rocking it. He's painting. He's got all kinds of art going on. And I just love him. I absolutely love him. His sound is so original, and we get into it on this interview. It's almost impossible these days to understand how hard it is to have your own sound, because there's a million zillion guitar players and bands. But back then, if you look at these people, if you listen to them actually, and you close your eyes, you just know who they are. You're like, oh, that's Stevie Ray. That's Jimmy. That's Angus. That's, you know, that is definitely Robbie Krieger. And that is a lot like what I strive to be as a comedian. They call it finding your voice as a comedian. Being able to be the person you are off stage and on stage. Same person. Mark is definitely that person. Bill is. Rogan. These comedians that they're talking to you in the hall. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. And then they go on and it's exactly the same person. Speaking of guitar playing, you got some joint ache? I got joint ache. I'm 54 today. My name is Joint Ache. Dean Joint Ache Delray. Get some CBD. I live for this stuff. CBD. Go to CBDLion.com. The cleanest CBD on the planet. Third party tested. I absolutely love this stuff. You having trouble sleeping? You got anxiety? You got joint ache? All of that stuff. This is going to help you out. Tinctures right under the tongue. Drop, drop. Next thing you know, I feel good. Let's get on an airplane for 4 hours. I can handle it. You got some joint ache? Topical. Rub it right on your neck, your elbows, your knees, whatever hurts. How about your pet? Is your pet a lunatic? Barking all the time. They got pet CBD. CBDLion.com. Use the code DEAN. DEAN. They also got bath bombs now. You out there taking baths? Throw one of these bath bombs in and put on some Doors music and take the ride. CBDLion.com, the great sponsor of Let There Be Talk. Support them. They're helping out the podcast. These guys are just great humans. CBDLion.com, use the code DEAN. All right. Let me get into a couple other things here, and then we will bring Robbie on. I recently was in Nashville and discovered this fantastic leathersmiths? Anyway, this amazing shop called Loyal Strickland, okay? And they make some of the greatest leather goods I've seen in a long time. Check out their Instagram, Loyal Strickland. That's LOYALSTRICKLIN. Loyal Strickland on Instagram out in Nashville. I went in there. I got an incredible bag, just unbelievable Horween leather bag, perfect for traveling. One of those roll top cool bags. Look at their stuff. It's unbelievable. Wallets, bags, backpacks, everything. Hit these guys up. I talked to him. He said, hey, tell him to use the code Dean and I'll give him 25% off one time only. This stuff is unbelievable. My bag will knock you out. I'm going to throw a picture up on it on the Instagram here and show it to you. Loyal Strickland, code is DEAN. Get 25% off leather goods. I love it. This guy is a craftsman, and I'm looking forward to having him on Let There Be Talk when I get back to Nashville. I'm going to have him on one of the handmade episodes. Great stuff. All right. Some new Patreoners, Brian Spink. Thank you so much. Gave me a little birthday donation there. I'm going to go have a steak on you, buddy. Thank you. Joe Sabo, Eddie Blankbick, Richie Tice, all brand new Patreoners. One last thing, then the show starts, okay? This is the most important. I'm out on the road. I'm headlining. People keep asking, please come to my town. I'm going to be all over the place, and I need you guys to buy tickets so I can keep coming back. Also, please Instagram and tweet and Facebook these dates. Tell your friends. Here they are. This Friday, I'm going to be in Santa Ynez with Bill Burr at the Chumas Casino. Then February 14th and 15th, I'm in Florida with Mark Maron. Awesome. Then I do February 20th, Portland, Maine with Maron. The 21st, Providence, Rhode Island. 22nd, New Haven, Connecticut, as Jim Morrison would say. Paramount, Huntington, New York, Paramount Theater. Now, here's the headlining dates. Listen here. They're one-nighters. February 26th. The Chapel in San Francisco. Please get tickets. They're all on DeanDelRay.com. Vegas with Joey Diaz, Treasure Island, February 28th. Austin, Texas, March 7th. I'm headlining one night in Austin. I've not headlined in Austin, so please tell friends and let's try to pack this. Two nights in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, March 13 and 14. And Tempe Improv is up now. And that is in March also. And Elko, Nevada, I think it's Elko, Nevada in March. Okay, all the tour dates, DeanDelRay.com. I also want to thank the Whiskey A Go-Go, Amy, and the Maglieri family for having me at the Whiskey and hooking up this incredible interview. Here he is, Robbie Krieger. I don't have a premise. It's basically I have people on the show that have inspired me in my life, and you have definitely done that. So introduce yourself, my man.
All right. It's Robbie Krieger from the Doors. We're in the 60s.
From the 60s. We're sitting right here.
Still going after 40.
Yeah, how old are you? 74?
50 years. Yeah. How do you know?
Oh, I looked it up.
Oh, I thought that was just a guess.
yeah, I guess. I before a podcast, and I was a carnival age guesser and weight, and it bounced me out of there. We're sitting here at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you this question because I've been coming here since the 80s. How much different is it from when you played here as far as layout and everything? Is it the same?
It's pretty close. You know, the stage actually was like right about here. They added this part to it, and it was high. It was always, I think this is about the height that it was. And in those days, it was fancy schmancy. You know, it was like checkered tablecloths and... And then they had the go-go cages up there. It was, you know, it was more like a New York kind of club.
Right.
Yeah.
And was the London Fog right next door?
No, it was about a block up.
By the Roxy, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, not that far, but just the side of the Roxy, I think.
And so was that place more kind of a dump and you were dying to get in here?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, the London Fog was kind of more like the whiskey is now, you know. It was like kind of, I think we made $5 a night.
$5 a night?
Each.
Each?
Yeah.
That's so good money, man.
It wasn't bad in those days, yeah.
I mean, back then rent was like 50 bucks, right?
Well, no, not that low, but it was probably about 200 for a nice place.
Now, you've been in L.A. your whole life, right? Mm. Born and raised here? And where were you born? In Los Angeles?
Yeah, I was born in Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. And we lived down near the airport when I was a baby. And then later, when I was 3 or 4, we moved up to Palisades, Pacific Palisades.
Is that where you live now? You used to have a place out there, right?
Well, I mean, I lived there when I was a kid, but no.
Did you have some crazy, like, roundhouse or something, like an architectural house?
You know what that was? That was actually my dad's house that he built, like, in the 70s. It was actually hexagonal. Every room was hexagonal. It was a cool house. In fact, Fred Durst bought it and flipped it maybe 10 years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then it's been, like, all over the news lately because this guy bought it and said, and he made it sound like it was my house. You know,
yeah.
Oh, this is Robbie Krieger's house. And they had a picture of the doors up there and, you know, to sell it, of course, which I thought was not that kind of sleazy.
That's wild.
It was a great house. You know, it's my dad was an architect. I mean, he was really a rocket scientist.
Really?
Yeah. But he was good at architecture, all that stuff. So he designed the place himself, and it was really nice.
Did he frown upon you wanting to play music since he was like a rocket scientist?
not really. I mean, you know, I think he was just happy that I found something I like to do rather than get arrested and stuff, you know, which I did a few times before that.
I got to tell you, I think that I feel the Doors are one of the heaviest bands of all time without distortion, without the obvious things of, like, say, a Zeppelin, of that kind of heavy. But when I listen to the Doors, it's as heavy to me as something that Zeppelin would do, or even later on bands that are considered heavy. And probably it was the original heavy band, don't you think?
You know, I mean, I don't think you'd call it heavy metal by any means, but, you know, it had those elements that I think all those guys took something from us, you know. Now, Hello, I Love You, that's got some pretty crunchy, you know, distorto guitars in it. But other than that, you know, I pretty much plug straight into a Fender Twin Reverb. And, you know, I might have had a Gibson Maestro fuzz tone, but that was about it.
Wow, right into, those are the loudest amps made back then, right? You put that thing on, it's just screaming.
Oh, yeah, they're loud enough. They're still a good amp. Yeah, in fact, what I use now is the Fender Deluxe, Hot Rod DeVille.
Oh, yeah, those are great.
Yeah, which is pretty much like a twin. They have the 410s, and then they have a 212s.
How did you decide on that amp early on? Was because of the power? Like, you didn't go Marshall or anything ever?
Yeah, I never liked Marshall. They were too kind of crunchy for me. You know, I think they sound better with a Fender guitar than Gibson, which I always use. I just always liked the sound of a twin. You know, I had the black-faced one, I had the silver-faced one. And you know who Paul Warren is?
Yeah.
Yeah, he had this tweed twin. which I always loved. That I was always trying to buy it off of him. And now I found out that Joe Bonamassa has got a whole bunch of those, so I'm trying to get one from him.
Yeah, those are great. And also, I love the high-powered Tweed Twin. You know, that's the Keith Richards holy grail right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you get an amp that is, you can play as loud as you want and clear without breaking up, then you can do any, you know, you can always use a pedal or something to break it up. But it's got that power and cleanliness, too.
I wanted to ask you this. I've been doing the show 8 years, and most people that come on the show, I always ask them what got them into music, because they're either my age or a little older, and it's either Kiss or Zeppelin. But who was it for you? Was it Elvis, seeing Elvis on TV, or what got you going?
Well, it was Elvis, hearing him on the radio with Hound Dog. I think that was the first, you know, song that really... It was my mom. She liked Frank Sinatra and all that stuff. So I'd always, you know, listen to the radio. And, you know, I like that stuff pretty much. But when Elvis came on, wow, that just changed the whole ball game, you know. And then when you bought the Hound Dog, on the back of it was Don't Be Cruel.
Oh, man.
That's a pretty good flip side there.
That's a great single right there. Yeah, I think you got your money's worth on that.
Yeah, 98 cents.
So after hearing Elvis, do you realize, wow, I've got to play in a band, or does it take you a while?
No, it took a while. You know, I went through a period where I really liked, you know, when I used to go to the Boys Club in Santa Monica. And on the jukebox there, they had Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley. And people, you know, we would just play that over and over until we wore it out, you know, because that was the only kind of rock thing on the jukebox. So I dug that. But after that, I kind of, you know, rock kind of got a little corny, you know, with the early Beach Boys stuff and the early Beatles and stuff like that. So I was kind of a snob, you know. I liked folk music. I liked Bob Dylan, yeah. You know, Joan Baez, Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Great stuff.
Stuff like that, yeah.
Were you going to see shows here in L.A.? Were you hanging out on the Strip?
When I got old enough, I mean, you know, you couldn't get in here unless you were 21.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I used to go to the Ash Grove and the Troubadour. So the Troubadour was only folk in those days. You used to see people like Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, Bud and Travis, and a lot of the old blues guys came through too at the Ash Grove. And that was pretty cool. See Buddy Guy and Muddy and Albert and
wow,
all them guys.
Wes Montgomery.
Yeah. Used to see him downtown.
Man, that's some old school. I mean, the Troubadour and the Whiskey. It's crazy the history of these rooms, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was funny because in the Troubadour in those days, it was totally folk. There was no rock there at all. I don't know when they started doing rock at the Troub, but we never even thought about playing there, you know?
Yeah, even the stage two of that room, when they get into like Linda Ronstadt and then the creation of the Eagles and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. And then I remember I saw Fear there.
You saw who, Fear?
Fear.
Wow, Lee Ving, Fear,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, Lee Ving, yes.
Wow.
So that was more of the 80s, I think.
Right.
Yeah, so finally it made the total transition from Bud and Travis to Fear.
Yeah, I think it was all about ticket sales then. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
When you get your first guitar, is it just like a copy, or was it a good guitar?
Well, you know, when I first started getting serious about guitar, I wanted to play flamenco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because my dad...
I mean, that's a lot of your style.
Well, yeah.
Like finger picking and...
Mm-hmm. My dad had some flamenco records, you know, so... I actually got a really good flamenco guitar from Mexico. It was called Juan Ramirez P. And he was a cousin of the real Ramirez in Spain. You know, so for $150, I got this great, you know, flamenco Mexican flamenco guitar that was pretty much as good as a Spanish one. Because later I got the real one. I got a real Ramirez from Spain. And they were pretty similar.
Did you drive down there to get it?
No. I got it up here at some guitar shop. I think, what was that one on Pico?
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the acoustic place?
Yeah,
I love that place.
There's shows there now. In fact, Ray Manzarek played there one time.
So you were you got the flamenco guitar, and then how long in do you decide, I want to play some rock?
Okay, so I was flamenco, and then I got really into Bob Dylan and that kind of stuff. So I'd played, acoustic.
And were you writing songs?
Steel string. Nope, never wrote a song. I was just, I would play shows, I would copy Jack Elliott or Bob Dylan, stuff like that. That was when I was up at Santa Barbara in college.
Yeah.
And when I was at high school, I went to a private school up in Menlo Park called Menlo School. And that was like kind of a prep school for Stanford, for kids that wanted to get into Stanford.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind of neat. So we had a lot of guys from back east, and they turned me on to a lot of cool stuff.
Like what stuff?
The jug band.
Yeah.
Yeah, jug band stuff. Maria Muldaur, Jeff Muldaur. Who else? Oddly enough, the guy that produced the Doors records, Paul Rothchild, he had produced a lot of these records I was listening to back then, like Paul Butterfield.
Oh, yeah.
He had one called The Blues Project, in which there was a lot of cool blues guy, Mark Spalestra, Kerner, Ray, and Glover. Have you ever heard of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were cool. He produced two records for them. So all the stuff I was listening to was Paul Rothchild, right? And then when we finally got a record deal with Elektra.
That's crazy.
I go, well, this guy Paul Rothchild wants to produce. Wow. So cool. Yeah, he produced all my favorite records.
That's wild. That'd be like the Rick Rubin or a big producer now,
Right.
Is Paul, is he gone?
Yeah, unfortunately, he is gone. But his son, Dan Rothchild, plays with me quite a bit now. He sings and plays bass, and he's a great kid.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you come back from Santa Barbara and you get an offer to audition for the Doors, was it an audition or just an offer to play in the band?
It was an audition.
And what was that like?
Well, first, the reason I got into electric guitar is because I went and saw Chuck Berry.
Oh, wow. Where at?
At the Santa Monica Civic, and it was a blues show. Okay, so this was early Chuck Berry, before he kind of got bored and, got pickup bands and stuff. He had the real band, right? Johnny Johnson and all these guys. Oh, my God.
Before he just did the touring pickup band thing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's a classic, right? Just shows up. You ever seen that? He's yelling at him, faster, right. Faster, slower,
He doesn't even tell him what song. He just starts.
He just starts it, man. Then he demands to be paid in cash in a briefcase.
Yeah, and we're going to do this in B-flat.
Yeah. And they're like, what? And then he's yelling at him, wrong key. I saw that, man, like 2 feet away. I was like, whoa, this is a brutal gig. So you see him at the Santa Monica Civic.
Yeah, And we just happened to have some Acapulco Gold at the time.
Really
kind of made me, I think, notice more how good he was, And he was doing the duck walk and the whole thing, man. It was just one of the best shows I've ever seen.
That place is going crazy.
Yeah. And then, of course, after that, I saw Chuck Berry, even played on this bill with him, and he was terrible, fucking pickup bands.
Oh.
That was...
I love him in that, the Keith Richards movie, the documentary.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I fuck you up. He's so angry, man. I love... So you see him and you're like, all right, I got to get a guitar.
Yeah.
So an electric guitar. And is it immediately like SG? Why is it SG Junior P90s? What was it?
Yeah, it was actually the Melody Maker.
Right.
The cheapest one you
can get. Oh, the cheap one. Yeah, yeah. Ooh.
Because I wanted one like Chuck Berry, which was a 335.
Right.
But that was too much money, you know? So I went down to Ace Loans. You ever heard of that place?
Ace Loans?
Ace Loans.
No.
It's now Ace Music, but in Santa Monica, that's where everybody used to get their guitars because, they'd get pawn shop guitars. And he had some pretty good stuff there. So I can't remember whether it was a new, I think it was a used Melody Maker. And that's what I used on the first two albums.
Really?
Yeah.
It wasn't the SG Junior, huh?
No.
I never knew that. So what's the pickups on that? Those weird single coils?
Yeah.
And did you have the weird one with the plastic switches? Or was it just like a toggle switch or normal toggle? Because some of those early Melody Makers had like the plastic switch to turn the pickups on and off.
No, it was a regular.
Right.
Regular.
And toggle. That's what you used on the first two records?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Cheapo, it shows you it doesn't matter what the guitar is. It's the Indian, not the Arrow.
Well, you are one of those guys, and there's these people like Billy Gibbons. I tell the story. Billy Gibbons, he played Pearly Gates forever, this $1 million 59. But then I see him play a Gretsch plastic $2 guitar, and that's Billy Gibbons.
Yeah.
You can play anything, and it's like, shit, that's Robbie Krieger. I mean, that is like so hard these days. You can't pick out a guy like, oh, that's such and such. Maybe the last guys you could do would be like Slash or somebody. Mm. But, even Jerry Cantrell, you can really pick out his playing. But I'm saying these days, it's really tough to find your own sound. It's all kind of been done. But you really had this, the entire band was kind of this circusy, dark, evil sound.
Well, yeah, and we all had our kind of odd sounds for what we played, like Ray with the with the
kind of
classical with blues, blues and classical, because he grew up, in piano lessons doing all the classical stuff, but he lived in Chicago where, the blues, he used to go see Muddy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
One time he asked to sit in, but we wouldn't let him.
So let's run through this audition. How do they hear about you?
Well, John, who I knew from high school, Densmore, he had already started playing with them. And they actually did a demo. I don't know if you ever heard it.
I heard it in the box set, and I never knew they had that woman Patty or whatever on bass.
Mm-hmm.
I never even knew that until when that came out. I always thought, boom, it was you guys, and then off and running. But yeah,
yeah. So that was before I was even in the band.
And so Ray's brothers in the band,
right? Ray's brothers, both one played harp and the other played guitar. Rick and Jim and Morrison, who sounded kind of like a early teenager kind of voice, So what happened was, from that demo, they actually got a record deal on CBS.
No,
yeah,
really,
yeah. Because
I never even knew that.
Well, yeah, because Billy, what's his name? Guy that signed Bob Dylan, Billy James.
Oh, yeah.
He liked them. He heard the demo, I guess, and he signed them up to Columbia.
What songs are on that again?
It's like Hello, I Love You, Moonlight Drive.
People Are Strange?
No.
No?
A couple of, one called Go Insane, a couple of ones that never made it to anywhere. But, it was, but you could tell there was those words, Moonlight Drive had the great words and Hello, I Love You. So anyway, in those days, Columbia would sign a bunch of bands and they would see what would stick,
Yeah.
So Jim decided they had a meeting with the head honchos, right, to see where it was all going with Billy James. And Jim insisted on going, and he took a bunch of acid.
Oh, to the meeting?
I got this wired, Next day we were dropped.
Wow, next day. I wonder what went down in that meeting. He's just on acid in there.
I would have loved to have been there. I would love to have been
there. Oh, my God.
Fly on the wall, you know.
That's such an outlaw movement. It's weird, too, that the band didn't freak out. Like, hey, man, what are you doing? We just got dropped. I mean, that's pretty wild. I never heard that.
Yeah, but, you know, we didn't really have a whole lot of faith in that thing anyway, because, like I say, Columbia was known for signing a bunch of bands, and then they'd keep, like, 5% of them, you know?
Yeah. It.
And we really hadn't even played a gig at that point, you know? So we didn't have a following. There wasn't a whole lot of hope for that. But 6 or 8 months later, we were playing at the Whiskey, and the guys from Elektra came down, and they liked it.
At what point does it kind of take off with a draw? Was this strip kind of like it was in the 80s, where people were just going out every night? Was the band drawing, or was the scene drawing?
It was a scene.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. That was big time hippie heaven on the strip. Late 66, early 67. Yeah, that was a great, great place to hang out.
I mean, you guys get signed from Elektra, and then a week later, you're in doing your record, and then, like, 2 months later, the record's out.
Well, it wasn't quite that quick.
Well, it just seems like it, you know? Yeah. It just seems like lightning speed it was out.
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, I think we got signed in summertime. Maybe June or something like that, and the record was out in January.
Yeah.
Yeah, that probably doesn't happen today.
I mean, look at that debut record. It's so insane what's on it.
I know.
To think that the end was on that, I mean, for a record company to think like, go ahead and play. I mean, that's a time where it's...
Well, Elektra was cool that way.
Yeah.
You know, they were... had Jack Holtzman, who was owned the label.
He's amazing.
And he had Paul Rothschild producing, Bruce Botnick doing engineering, and they had done Love before us.
Yeah.
You know, and Love they were our idols, you know, because they were the biggest thing happening in L.A.
Yeah.
At the time, and so Paul and Bruce had done them, and. So we had total confidence in them. We'd been playing those songs all summer. So to record them was easy. It was just plug in, turn a tape machine on, and that was it.
What was Paul doing? Was he doing any arrangement changes, or was it just plug in and play?
He made one change, which is probably the best one he ever did, which was on Light My Fire.
Yeah.
Which was... the the intro, that was not an intro at the time. That was in the middle of the song to get back from the instrumental part back to the verse. Okay, so Paul said, man, that's a great part, let's stick that in the beginning and at the end. So it happens three times, if you notice, in Fire, you know, he's got that part,
and it's the hook,
of course. Yeah. Although, as it turned out, it really wasn't necessary, a hook, because Feliciano did it later without that part at all. Still made number one and made his whole career, just like it did for us.
When you go into Sunset Sound to do this record, is it 4-track, 8-track, 16?
4-track.
4-track,
yeah.
And
we thought that was pretty cool. You know,
yeah, right?
Because everything was 2-track before that.
And 2-inch tape?
No, 1-inch.
Whoa, 1-inch tape, 4-track.
Oh, and it might have been half inch. Yeah, I think it was half inch.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And all is it recorded live?
No. Like I said, we had 4 tracks.
Yeah.
So you had the organ and guitar on 1 track, which was stupid.
Yeah.
drums and voice in the middle. So that took 2 tracks. And then we had another track to overdub. So we do some of the vocals that he didn't get right on the first time around. For instance, I overdubbed the bass on a couple of songs. Soul Kitchen.
Yeah.
And Backdoor Man.
Yeah.
And then Larry Nechtel, who was a great session guy, he overdubbed the bass on Light My Fire. did the exact note for note that Ray did on the piano bass. So there's really two basses on
just
that
song. Just to fatten it up?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was growing up, the Doors was, it wasn't a band I understood growing up as a kid. I grew up in San Francisco Bay Area, and it was
so
like...
how old were you then?
53. Oh, back then?
Yeah.
When so I first started hearing the Doors, of course, it's in the 70s, and I'm like, I don't know about this. What is this, you know? And then the Doors are a band, when it fucking hits you, you go down a rabbit hole, and all of a sudden you're buying clothes to look like the Doors. You're being weird, you know. And then there was all these bands in the 80s that were really grabbing onto the Doors. Of course, like there was a band called The Front. They were dead on like
really?
The Doors, man.
Yeah, I never heard them.
Yeah, I'll send that over to you. But and the Doors were really
Echo and the Bunny Man.
What's that?
Echo and the Bunnymen, remember them?
Yeah, Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah. They were total Doors.
But once it grabs me, it's grabbed me for life, and at some points, full obsession. Wow. You know, just like, oh my God. Because it's this thing. My buddy said it yesterday. We were out hiking. Greg Dooley from the Afghan Whigs. You know that band?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Greg. So he goes, oh my God, Robbie Krieger's a god. He goes... What he did was he reinvented the blues, the Doors. They no one had ever been able to reinvent the blues.
Wow.
And I said, yeah, you're kind of like the L.A. blues, like Steely Dan's are like cocaine jazz, you know, like L.A. cocaine jazz. The Doors were like an L.A. blues band. And when you hear the Doors... It is L.A. to me, more than Van Halen ever. There's always that argument, what's the greatest debut L.A. band? Yeah. Is it Van Halen 1 or the first Doors? And it's the first Doors to me, because when I hear it, I feel Los Angeles. I feel Malibu. Mm. I feel Venice. I feel, you know, Mulholland.
Yeah, L.A. woman.
Yeah, L.A. woman, you know. You feel that, man.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I'm glad you feel that.
It's absolutely
Jim, yeah. Jim would love that because he, he thought he like he said the West is the best, you know.
The West is the West is the best. Yeah, and also with the Doors, you can't do it without doing Jim. You know, Mojo Rise. It's just it's in you, man.
Yeah, yeah.
When you guys do this record and it actually takes off. And you start touring. I looked at some of the touring schedule. You guys didn't really play a lot touring, right? It wasn't
not like they do today.
Yeah, so. I mean, like you do like 26 gigs and then go do a record. That's pretty wild, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was because Jim was so nuts that we couldn't take him on the road that long, you know, you know, especially once you have New Haven and then Miami.
Of course.
Nobody's going to take a chance on us, you know?
Right.
So we just said, all right, fuck it. We'll just record, you know? Which was good because we ended up doing 6 albums in 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. And the outpouring of writing was unbelievable. Now, you guys, like, you wrote some of the big, big hits. But I like how you smile on that. Now, when you guys are actually writing, was Jim actually writing those whole songs? Like, here's how it goes, and you guys would just get some music behind it?
Some of them. Like, he told us that he was up on Dennis Jacobs' roof, which is where he lived for a while.
Yeah.
It was like this place down in Venice, and it had a rooftop kind of cabana or something like that. So he said he would smoke this Acapulco Gold.
Yeah.
And a concert would come into his head, and all he had to do was write it down. You know, that's crazy.
And then he would hum the song to you?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
like the first, you know, Moonlight Drive.
Yeah.
That's how that happened with Ray on the beach. You've heard that story.
That story's nuts. Hey, I write songs. He's like, yeah, let me hear one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he starts singing it. I mean, imagine like if somebody came up to you right now and did that.
The thing is, you know, you could sing that song and and the music might come out in 100 different ways.
Right.
You know, so that's, Ray was great at you know, intuiting what Jim would, you know, for those first few songs especially. After that, you know, Jim and I would write together. And, you know, we just, I would play
something. Acoustic?
Yeah, yeah. And by that time, he'd kind of run out of those movie songs that he saw in his head. So he'd have to, you know, make up words or look in his poetry books and find something, you know.
Now, was the whole band getting crazy on psychedelics and stuff? Or were you just experimenting on it?
You know, actually, Jim was the one who was really into that. I mean, we all were, but John and I had been into it for a year or two before that. So we were kind of getting tired of it. You know, we were, you know, I was kind of the Timothy Leary of UCLA. Well, I used to give it to everybody.
No shit?
Yeah.
You were just passing out acid?
Yeah. I finally realized that was a dumb idea because, you know, one of my friends took too much and then he went nuts and, you know, I felt really bad. So that's when John and I started looking for something else, meditation, TM. You know, we were the first guys that, and Ray, because Ray had taken too much acid and he just, he'd had enough of it. So we all ended up at the first meditation meeting in L.A.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, first time Maharishi had come to L.A. and it was at my friend's house. My buddy Peter Wallace had gone to India. He was this one of these crazy guys. And he went to India in search of a guru.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to go search out a guru.
Yeah.
And I love that hippie shit.
Yeah. And he talked to a bunch of them, and then he met Maharishi, and he said, wow, this guy's the real shit. And he talked him into coming to L.A. So at his parents' house was the first meeting of, they didn't even call it TM yet, it was just called meditation.
Right.
And there was maybe 12 people there. And among those 12 was me, Ray, and John.
Wow. And did you get it right away? Because I've started meditating over the last couple weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I want to get into it. People are like, yeah, it'll help with blood pressure and anxiety.
Yeah.
And I haven't really, I'm trying, you know, but did you get it right away?
Well, no, it takes a lifetime, you know.
Yeah, it takes a lifetime.
But Ray thought it would be, like, immediate, right?
Yeah.
So
he's like, this shit ain't working.
Right. At the second meeting, he goes, the guy goes, any questions? And Ray says, no bliss. He thought it would be instant bliss.
Oh, my God.
That's what Maharishi always talked about, bliss, you know.
Yeah. And you still meditate?
I do. Yeah.
So daily?
Ray gave it up at that point. No, not every day, but, you know, more or less when I feel like I need it.
Yeah, with this L.A. traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you guys, your record, your first record's a hit, and then do you go out and buy this SG Junior, or how does this happen? Like, you're like, I need it.
My first one got stolen.
Oh, that Melody Maker?
Yeah.
Oh, bastards.
Yeah.
Was it a tobacco burst?
No, it was red.
Oh, it was red? Yeah, oh, one of those, red. Like the stain, like cherry stain.
Yeah, it was kind of dark, you know, red. Maybe it was tobacco. I don't.
It got stolen on the road?
No, just at our rehearsal place, I think.
Oh, God. And you only had one guitar?
Yeah.
I love it.
So,
you got a record deal, you got one guitar.
Yeah, in those days, nobody collected guitars.
Yeah, you hear that, you guys?
I mean, it was crazy. So, and I didn't even care. I just went and bought another one, you know. I bought a black one with, what was it, SG, with two pickups.
With
humbuckers.
With the humbuckers?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. At what point do you get that 54? Like, is that around the L.A. Woman record? You get that weird 54 Les Paul?
That was around, it was a little before that. This buddy of mine, Rocky, had, I don't know where he got it, but he wanted to sell it quick. So I got it for, I think I gave him $400 for it. Nice guitar. I still have that one.
Did you modify it yourself, or is that how it was with that weird pickup situation?
And that's how it was.
Wow.
Or no, I did do modify that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know why I did that. But
when you go in for the second record, is it like total pressure because you had this big record? Is Elektra changed now? Is Paul like, we got to get this going?
No, but, you know, it was different. It was totally different because, you know, the first record we were, didn't have any money or time, so we just had to do it real fast.
Right.
And the second album was like making Sgt. Pepper's.
Oh my God.
It was in the studio for weeks on end and, you know, 8 hours for a drum sound and shit like that, which, you know, I thought we were kind of overdoing it there. But, you know, came out with some good stuff.
There was some good stuff on that. I love the Ed Sullivan performance. I love a lot of the TV performances, the ones that aren't lip-synced, you know. But the Ed Sullivan one is, that show is so monumental back in the day. Like, you played that, it made you.
Yeah, exactly. That was the biggest, you know, that was like MTV in those days. Because that's the only national show you could play that, you know, got to everybody. So all that, you know, you always, that was the goal to get on Ed Sullivan.
Oh, my God, yeah. At that point, your parents got to be flipping out, right? They're like, oh, my God, you're on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah, they loved it, yeah. They were our biggest fans. They used to, they followed us around Europe and stuff.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
That is amazing,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, they were pretty cool about the whole thing. You know, they loaned us money to buy a piano bass one time, which was pretty cool because, like you said, my dad was like a rocket scientist. And, you know, I'm sure he wanted me to be, you know, at least finish college, you know, which I didn't. Once we started playing the whiskey and we got the record deal, I just stopped going to UCLA.
You know? Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny because you guys were all college guys. Yeah. You know, to think about that, like, these guys were in college. Like, I don't know. When I was growing up, I don't know any. The band guys were dudes that couldn't go to college. They're like, I didn't even make it out of high school. But you guys were like UCLA and Santa Barbara college guys.
Yeah. It's the only reason I was in college was to stay out of the draft, to tell you the truth. But it worked for a while. But still had to go in for the physical and lie and cheat and say I was gay or something.
It's funny how your music was such a soundtrack to the Vietnam War.
Yeah,
really wild.
Yeah,
and one of the most.
So many guys have I've talked to from that are vets and say that we got them through that whole thing.
Yeah.
And the Doors was one of the favorite bands over there, which is why, you know, Oliver Stone was obsessed with the Doors.
Yeah, of course.
When he was over there, he was real into the Doors.
When I first met you, I said, I had like an extra part in that Doors movie when I was a kid, and you said, fuck that movie. But you guys really hated that film, right? I mean, as far as I could see it, you going like, that's not what happened. But it did make this massive second wave of fans.
No, I think you're thinking of Ray Moore. Ray hated the movie.
Oh, Ray hated the movie.
Yeah, Ray hated the movie. I actually worked on the movie trying to, you know, make it better. But I at least got I made sure that the concert scenes were true to life. So he did do a great job of the Miami thing, the one in, we did one up in San Francisco.
Yeah,
and,
I was at the Olympic Theater one. So that was supposed to be Miami.
That's right.
The Sheep. And, I mean, I was blown away when I first saw, because when I was there on the set, they're like, look, when Val gets here, you got to call him Jim. Right. And we were laughing. We're like, I'm fucking dumb, you know? And then he came in and we were like, oh, what the fuck? I couldn't believe it, actually.
Yeah, no, he was great. He should have got Academy Award for that, for sure.
Yeah, he got robbed, huh?
Yeah. I forget who got it that year, but...
Yeah.
I don't think he was even nominated.
I don't think so, yeah. Which is strange, because... Yeah. I mean, I heard the story was they already had a Jim casted, and then they gave this VHS tape to Oliver Stone and said, hey, check this guy. And he goes, I already got a guy doing Jim. They're like, no, you want to check this out. And he looked at it, and then he was like, who is that? And they're like, Val Kilmer. I mean, I don't know if that's...
No, Val, yeah, he, in fact, he showed me the video. It was, Val actually had a Doors tribute band just, you know, before he was even doing films. And he said, hey, check this out. And I said, wow. You know, but he looked nothing like Jim, you know, in that film or, you know, before he had the makeup and stuff. But once he got in the character, man, he made you believe it.
That was heavy, yeah. Right? I mean, it was, were you like watching that? Like, wow, this is kind of, this is pretty insane.
Yeah, same with you. I was calling him Jim.
Yeah.
You know?
You were calling him Jim. Yeah. You. Yeah. That is classic. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I remember the Matt Dillon's brother was the drummer.
Right. Right.
Kevin. And I remember between scenes, they were coaching him on movement.
Yeah, my buddy Bruce Gehry was the drum coach. And he.
And who played you?
Well. A guy named Frank Whaley. Frank Whaley's. Good actor. He'd been in a lot of stuff after that. He was in that Jimmy Hoffa movie where he shot Jimmy Hoffa in the car, remember? And he's a good actor. And then who did Ray? Kyle.
Oh, wow.
Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah.
I just remember they had me looking like Paul Williams.
Really?
I was wearing a white leather jacket with fringe. And leather pants with friends. And
so which scene were you in?
I was supposed to be in this kind of backstage scene. It never made it. When he shows up and he says, how is it out there? And we're like, oh, it's rough, because they booed the band off.
At the Miami show, right?
What, at the Miami show. Yep. And then it comes out and he was 5-1.
All right.
And he was really singing that, right?
Oh, yeah. He sang like 90%.
It was unbelievable.
He was really good, man.
Yeah.
Yep. And after that, yeah, he'd come and sit in with me once in a while.
He would come and sit in?
Yeah, yeah. A couple of years ago, we did it up at, where was it? Minneapolis, I think.
I saw you play you in Golden Gate Park in San Fran. And it was years ago, like probably 25 years ago or something. And you were killing it. You were singing.
I was singing.
Yeah, you were singing some of the songs, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I still do that.
Yeah, and I was like, hey, this guy's smoking it, man.
I should have been the singer.
Wait, when you guys were out on the road, would Jim's voice ever go south?
Never. Hardly ever. No. I mean... You know, sometimes he'd sing in a lower octave, and I could tell his voice was a little mashed up.
Yeah.
But never really lost his voice like so many people I know have done. You know, so easy to do it with the Doors songs, because, you know, some of that stuff is, those notes are hard to hit. The fire!
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And especially back then, the shit monitors.
Right.
It's just
right.
Side fills or no monitors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jim was... I felt bad for him because, you know, like you say, no monitors. So he'd have to go out just to the point of feedbacks just so he could hear himself in the house.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's talk a little bit about that first trip up to San Francisco to the Matrix Club. Those are some amazing recordings, and pretty early on of the group, like right when the record comes out, right? You guys go up there.
Right.
I've got those Matrix tapes.
Yeah.
And, what was that run like? Was that your first run to San Francisco?
No, I think we'd been there a couple of times. So we played at the Fillmore, and then what was the other place? Chet Helms, not the Winterland, but the Family Dog.
Oh yeah, Family Dog.
Family Dog. So we'd play at one of those places. And then during the week, that would be on the weekend. So during the week, you'd play at the Matrix, which was owned by Marty Balin's dad. And they would record everything. So, we got some pretty good recordings. And it's so funny because, you know, we'd play a song, and after the song is done, you'd hear, 10 people clapping.
10 people. It's interesting versions, though, because they're not, they're kind of, not stock, but they're really kind of in the box. You're not stretching out yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's wild to hear that kind of early on.
Yeah, in fact, that was right about the time when we were recording. I don't remember if it was the first or the second album, but, and you know, when you're recording in the studio, you're playing those songs over and over again, so that's probably why it kind of sounds like that, because, you know, it was just kind of automatic.
Yeah.
Instead of too much improvisation.
Did you guys have a good record deal back then, or was it one of those classic ripoffs?
It started to be a classic ripoff. The good thing about it was most record deals then were 5 years, and ours was 3 years, which was good because after 3 years, if you're doing really good, then they really want to sign you back. So
renegotiate.
Yeah, exactly, which is what happened. Because what happened in those days is when you sign a record deal, you would pretty much automatic sign your publishing away. So we got $5,000 for our publishing. We said, wow, we're rich, $5,000, you know. And then luckily we got our publishing back.
You got it back.
Because of the three-year thing, you know.
That's an incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
And
because most bands signed away their publishing for even less than $5,000 a lot of times.
And then you've owned it ever since?
Yep.
Wow. Because I know there was that long period of time where it was like no Doors in the commercials or anything. Like John Densmore was really fighting you guys on that and stuff, right?
Yeah. Well, we still do, and we haven't had a commercial ever. You know, the funny thing was, back in the day, Buick wanted to light my fire.
Yeah.
Buick. And it was this little cool little Opel, Buick Opel car that was low on gas and it was like the new thing. So we thought, hey, that sounds pretty cool. You know, nobody had ever done a car commercial with rock and roll. But Jim, we couldn't find him. He was nowhere to be found. So we said, all right, he'll like it. We'll just do it, you know. So we signed it. And, of course, when Jim found out about it, he said, you didn't tell me, blah, 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 you know. I mean, it was my song, you know. but he went so nuts about it that we said, okay, we won't do it. We'll pull out of the deal. So ever since that, we never did a commercial. And so now it comes up to... the time of when Ray and I decided to go out and play the Doors again, year 2000.
Right.
And John didn't want to play. So he decided, right at that time, Cadillac comes up with this offer of like, I forget it was, 10, 15 million bucks for to use Break On Through.
10, 15 million bucks.
Yeah. And Ray wanted to do it because he'd been in some financial trouble or something. And John didn't want it. You know, I would have done it just for Ray, you know.
Yeah.
John said, no, can't do it. Because, he was mad at us for going out without him because we got Stuart Copeland and stuff like that.
But he didn't want to do it. That's the crazy part about it.
Well, yeah, and I think it was more or less to spite Ray. Rather than, being so altruistic to the music. Oh, you can't. Yeah, and then what happened? Led Zeppelin did it. Ended up doing it, you know.
Jeez.
But to this day, we haven't used it in a commercial.
Who owns the stuff? Is it just you and John now?
One quarter each.
One quarter? Mm-hmm.
That's how it's always been.
So
Ray's relatives have one quarter, and Jim's... estate has the other quarter.
Wow. I mean, that you guys have sold over 100 million records, man.
Is that all?
Is that over 100 million records? There's only a handful of bands ever to do that.
And we are the only bands ever to split publishing four ways.
That's
And that was Jim's idea. Even at that time, he was writing all the songs. You know, I hadn't even written Light My Fire yet, and he goes, listen, you guys, I want to split everything four ways, you know, because he knew we wouldn't put up with him if he didn't do that.
Were there times where it was just insane, where you're just like, this guy is absolutely a lunatic?
Yeah, I think there was enough of those times where we would have broke up had it not been for that four-way split.
Oh, you know? Shit.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good thing for bands to do, really.
Right.
If they're serious, they should.
Especially John Densmore. I mean, he's not writing anything, right?
Right.
I mean, and then there he is blocking you guys. It's like, hey, man, you're getting a cut of something you didn't write. Get in on this. I do understand that hold this this thing that Jim was so behind, not commercializing, but this is a whole different era now. And as you get older and stuff, right, and like you said, exactly. Ray was financially in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a way. It's your money. That's what it is.
Yep. You know, I mean, there is the argument that, hey, it's pretty cool never to do a commercial because, you know, money is bad. You know.
Yeah.
You're embarrassed about.
Yeah.
You know, we're supposed to be artists and all this shit, but I didn't see it that way.
Do you look at that New Haven concert? I look at it as the day the outlaw rock and roll star was born. That day, I look at it like that, and I think most people do. All of a sudden, it was this blueprint of "fuck the man, we are rock and roll," and you know, there's the headshot. Next thing you know, everybody's a radical.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Yeah, Jim was pretty pissed. I don't blame him, you know?
Yeah, getting maced.
Yeah. I mean, why did he have to do that? You know, the guy didn't realize who Jim was, obviously.
Right.
He thought he was just somebody that snuck backstage. And, you know, of course, Jim's not one who's going to sit and explain something to a guy. You know?
Yeah.
So, he got maced and then told the story in the middle of Backdoor Man. He says, oh, you know what happened backstage? You know, this man, funny little man in a funny blue suit and a funny little hat.
Yeah. Are you up there like, oh, shit?
Yeah.
Like, you got to be thinking, like, this is going down.
Because there was a whole bunch of cops right down in front, you know?
Yeah.
And which was kind of weird because I'd never seen that many cops at a show before, you know? I don't know why there were so many, but they hauled him off stage and smacked him around a bit.
Man.
It was in Life magazine, big picture on the right next to the back cover.
Instant stardom from that. I mean, that's just like every teenage boy is like, yeah, fuck yeah.
Right.
You know, I got to get leather pants and that and that belt here, that concho belt.
Right,
and
the concho belt.
Let's talk a little bit about the Hollywood Bowl, because we're here at the Whiskey, and I always heard the rumblings of we want to build a PA big enough to where they could hear us down at the Whiskey a Go-Go. Who built that? The company Acoustic?
We were with a company called Acoustic Amps, and tell you the truth, the guitar amps kind of sucked because they were like 2 15-inch woofers,
just,
and then a horn.
Yeah, zero breakup.
Yeah, exactly. They're great for keyboards and bass. They had a good bass amp, the 360 bass amp. But so for guitar, I actually jimmied my own one that it looked like an acoustic, but it had different stuff in it. But anyway, so that for the Hollywood Bowl, we said, man, we want to be really loud because this is a big place and we want to be able to hear it down at the Whiskey. So we got Acoustic to bring all their amps down there. 52.
Whoa.
52 amps.
Whoa.
Stretched across the stage. So we're warming up. We're getting ready to play, and then all of a sudden this guy comes up, and he's got this a dB meter.
Goes, oh yeah.
Oh, by the way, guys, you can't go over 100 dB at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
The neighbors will complain. So, oh shit. And especially for me, because you know, I already have too little breakup, you know, with one amp, much less 10. So I ended up using one.
Whoa. And so you went by the rules?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
What else can we do? They would have pulled the plug.
So there it is, this full system up there, and it's just on two.
All right. the guitar sounds so bad.
How was that?
If I was smart, I would have just went and got a twin reverb, you know. That's what I should have done.
Was it a good gig?
It was, except for the guitar sound, it was a good gig.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there you are, playing the Hollywood Bowl,
yeah.
The iconic venue in your hometown. It's kind of like you, I mean, you already made it, but I'm saying this is it, our homecoming gig.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that part of it was cool. And let's see, who played with us? I think it was Steppenwolf and maybe the Chambers Brothers. It was fun, but just horrible guitar sound. I mean, they made it sound okay on the
yeah,
on the
sounds
film.
Great.
Yeah,
I love that one. I love that one, and I love the felt form one.
You can't play right if your sound isn't right. You know?
Oh, not at all. It's just dying out,
yeah.
Especially if you're playing slide.
Yeah,
you know, you play a lot of slide
or long, you know, sustain notes. I couldn't do my music sober thing.
Yeah,
very good. I was just pissed.
When you look at the catalog of the Doors records, which one do you think is your favorite if you really listen to them all?
You know, it changes, you know, depending on which one I'm listening to.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's good stuff on all of them, you know.
Oh, of course.
And there's not much bad stuff.
No, there's not.
I mean, that's the deep tracks are all good, so that's what I like about it. You know, when I play the Doors stuff, you know, whoever I'm playing and whoever's in the band, they always want to play the deep tracks. You know,
yeah.
Hey, let's play.
Like 20. Not to Touch the Earth.
Yeah. Something.
That kind of haunting stuff. The right. Changeling. That,
yeah.
That stuff is just insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. A lot of people never heard that, you know. So that's what makes it fun to play Doors music for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I gotta say, I love the L.A. Woman record.
Oh, yeah.
You
oh,
know, yeah. I love everything about it. I love the cover. I love, what's his name from Elvis Presley's band on bass?
Jerry Schiff.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just love the vibe of that record. It was kind of like, okay, we made it out of the 60s. We're still a band. And you're recording this really cool blues rock record.
Yeah. You know what? That record, to me, it had Jim come back from Paris like he was supposed to. That's the direction we would have kept going.
Right.
Because we actually wrote some of that stuff as a band, which was the first time we'd ever done that. It was always, you know, either me or Jim, or me and Jim, or just Jim. And this time, for instance, the song L.A. Woman, we were just jamming around, and it kind of happened, you know? It's crazy. That and Riders on the Storm.
Those two tracks are just insane.
Yeah.
Now, that's the one Rothschild quits, right? He's like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
He produces all your records but that one. He's like, this sounds like some... what did he say?
cocktail music.
Yeah, cocktail music.
Yeah. Riders on the Storm, he said.
Yeah.
Sounds like cocktail music because of the tinkly piano.
Did he ever call you later and go, man, I was wrong?
No.
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 After he
wasn't that kind
after
of guy.
He quits, is it a sour fallout?
No, not really. I mean, you know, he had just produced Janis' first solo album. You know, he saw himself going, you know, to him, the Doors were on their way down. You know, I hate to say that about him, but. I think that's what was in his mind, and he could tell that Jim was kind of, you know, going downhill, and he had just had that happen with Janis, and he just said, hey, I can't do this again, you know. I kind of don't blame him.
Man, that was definitely an insane spiral in a quickness of that.
Yeah,
of
Jimmy, like, and then Janice, and then
yeah.
And Jim said, after the two of them, he said, "I'm next."
That part's spooky, right? Yeah. Do you give into that conspiracy of, like, you know, these people, he was alive and there was no body and all this stuff? Did you guys ever dig into that?
No, man. He was pretty sick when he went to Paris.
He had
a horrible cough. I don't know. He might have had pneumonia for all I know. And in Paris at that time, that they were just getting into the China White thing, you know, which his old lady was into, Pam. And then, of course, Courvoisier and all that shit.
Yeah.
You can't do that along with the other.
No.
For very long.
Do you think there was heroin involved in that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I can't say for sure.
Yeah.
But, even without heroin, it just... drinking too much, the condition he was in, he had no filter, you know what I mean? He just didn't know how to relax, you know?
Yeah, he was all in. Wild. Let's talk Hot Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You guys had Eddie Vedder sing.
Yeah.
And that was pretty damn cool. Were you aware of Vedder before, or keeping up with, like, newer music at that time?
Yeah, a little bit, you know. We knew all about the, you know, grunge thing, and I forget whose idea it was to get Eddie to sing, but that was perfect. And he was a huge Doors fan, you know. He cornered me that day and for about 2 hours, you know, just everything about Jim he wanted to know, you know. And the funny thing was, we had a big storm that day, the day before the Grammys, so he decided to drive down from Seattle.
Wow.
And
drive down to L.A.?
Yeah.
Wow.
So he almost missed the whole thing because of the storm, you know. So we didn't get to rehearse, really. It was just
a
sound check kind of thing. And Don Was played bass, but it came out good.
It was great.
Yeah.
And just you guys are, as they would say, first ballot Hall of Famers. Like, can you imagine if you didn't go in the first run? It'd be like, the place would burn to the ground.
Was that the first year?
I mean, it was the first time you guys were up. I think you were eligible. You just went right in.
When did they start that Hall of Fame?
I don't know, actually.
I think it wasn't too far, but, you know, I don't think we were that far down the line.
I don't know. I think what they did back then was they started in the 50s. So they went through the 50s bands. So, like, Elvis, Chuck Berry, all that. And then they got to the 60s and you guys went right in. I think that's how they did it.
Yeah.
Chuck Berry. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they start with the 50s. There it is, full circle for you.
Yeah.
Chuck Berry.
Wow,
yeah.
That's cool.
What was the Isle of Wight like? You guys went out there and played. Was that your first giant festival in Europe?
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Everybody was there. Jimmy, the Stones, and... Wow. It was kind of a fuck-up because that was the first time, I think, that they charged too much, and the kids were mad, and they broke down the barriers, and a bunch of kids got beat up and thrown in jail, and Joni Mitchell was in tears, and, you know, it was kind of a mess. But it was cool just to see all those great bands and to be on that show. But the problem was, Jim was, at that time, he was kind of in a bad mood because of the trial was hanging over his head, you know, and he was kind of fat. He gained a bunch of weight, and he had the big bushy beard. And so they were filming the whole thing, Murray Lerner. And so Jim says, right before we go, and he goes, "You can only have red lights."
Oh, red lights. Oh,
dark red.
Darker.
And Murray Lerner's going crazy. We can't do that. It's going to be horrible. That's it. Take it or leave it, you know. So that's why it looks so dark when we're playing, which is kind of cool, I think.
Yeah, well, it matches the band and the music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't see how fat Jim is either.
No.
but he was kind of boring that night. He just kind of went going through the motion. You know, he sang well. He sang really good, but he just unearthed the mic and didn't move an inch. That's kind of weird.
That's unusual. Like, when you see a guy going through different phases, you got to be kind of like, uh-oh, here we go. Yeah, this is going to be something different tonight.
Yeah. But they just put the film out, I think. Doors at the...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Were you guys actually bummed you didn't do Woodstock? I had heard that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was Ray's fault.
Yeah.
Ray decided, are you kidding? Woodstock? Nobody's going to come to that, man. It's too far from New York. You know, it's going to be a bust.
Ray said that?
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Stupid.
So you guys, did you get offered to play it?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, we could have played there.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, no, we didn't get offered to play at the Monterey.
Oh, Monterey Pop.
Yeah.
But Jim went to that. There's photos of him there, right?
No.
No?
No, we were playing in New York at the time. We couldn't get out of our gig in New York.
Oh, that's right. I read about that. It was like...
The Scene. Steve Paul, The Scene Club. We had a contract to play there.
Yeah, that sucks.
But you know what? They didn't even invite us anyway.
Yeah.
Because Lou Adler, I think, was pissed at us.
Right, he moved some dates or something, I read. Like... he did some kind of mojo where you couldn't do it. Like,
no, he just didn't. He was mad at us because he wanted to produce us.
Oh.
And we didn't want him to produce it.
Oh, man.
That's what I think, anyway.
Were there other producers you ever thought about when you guys were working with Paul?
No.
That was it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a perfect fit for me, anyway. I certainly wouldn't have picked anybody else. That was my dream producer. You know, looking back,
yeah,
I kind of would have been nice to have had, you know, one of those great producers of the day, but not Lou Adler.
Yeah, not Lou Adler.
Zappa wanted to produce it.
Zappa?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, how did that come about? That's cool.
He used to hang out the Whiskey and see us play, you know, and... You know, but in those days, Zappa was like a kind of a parody band or something. You know, it was the Mothers of Invention. It was
right.
It was all, you know, humor, and we just didn't think he would be right for us. You know,
Zappa.
He might have been cool.
That is wild, yeah. Man. What kind of bands were you seeing? Did you see Zeppelin and stuff in here? Were you going to that?
I never saw I did. No, that was Jimmy Page. What was the earlier band he was in?
The Firm? Oh, Yardbirds?
Yardbirds.
Oh, wow, you saw Yardbirds.
Saw Yardbirds. And I saw Jimmy at the Whiskey.
Yeah.
I saw Cream at the Whiskey.
Whoa. Yeah. You saw Jimmy here?
Yeah, at the Whiskey.
Whoa. What, Cream?
Yeah.
How about Chicago? Were you hanging out with those guys?
Yeah. In fact, Panko lived right across the street from me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Terry was a friend of mine. His second wife was good friends with my wife. And
Terry was a monster.
Yeah.
Jesus, man.
Yeah, he was cool.
I mean, just think about that music scene that was going down. We're sitting here in the Whiskey. It's like you guys, Jimmy... you know, Cream.
Otis Redding.
It's insane to think about what, and this building's still here. That's what's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
How did it come about that Ian starts singing with you guys? Did you look at other guys? I mean, I remember you guys did that one thing for MTV where you had different singers, right?
Right.
So how does Ian lock into that?
Well, Ian, he was always a big Doors fan.
Of course.
And he was a friend of Danny Sugarman, who wrote the book.
Yeah.
And was actually our manager for a while. So, you know, he was always trying to get Ian together with us, and, you know, it was always something would happen. Ray and John weren't getting along, or Ray and I weren't getting along, and it's just never right timing. And so just at that time, right, about the year 2000, I guess the cult really wasn't, kind of broke up for a while or something.
Right.
And it was the perfect timing. Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, man.
I wish that would have lasted longer. But
I saw it at some Harley Davidson event.
Oh, yeah.
And you guys were killing it. I was like, this is amazing.
That was our first show.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Yeah, Stuart Copeland on drums.
That thing was great, man. You guys were killing it.
Yeah, that was good.
Were you going out to the punk rock scene a lot? You were talking about seeing Fear, but did punk grab you a lot?
A little bit.
Yeah. X, mean, you know, Fear, Devo, sure. Were you into that stuff?
All that stuff, yeah. Not as much as Ray. You know, Ray really, you know, he produced X and stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I was trying to do jazz and stuff more at that time.
Now, what do you got, like 6 solo records out?
Something like that.
Yeah. How much do you play now?
Quite a bit, you know.
Yeah.
Mean, not as much as some people, I'm sure, but like my buddy Alice Cooper, man.
Yeah.
Does 300 nights a year. I don't know how he does it.
That's crazy, right?
I know. But I like to play just for fun. I have different projects. Like right now, I got this thing with some jazz guys, and we just play around town, you know, like at the Canyon Club or places like that. And then, you know, the door stuff, I do that as well with my son Waylon singing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Pretty cool.
How old's your son?
He is 46, but he acts like he's 26.
Well, that's how it's got to be, man, right? Yeah. Acts like he's 26. You're 74. How's your hearing? Mine's fried.
What?
Yeah.
No, actually, it's not that bad. You know, I actually went and got some hearing aids, and to tell you the truth, they don't really make much difference, you know. Now, my son, Waylon, his hearing was really bad, and we both got the hearing aids. And he said it just changed his whole life. It's you know, if your hearing is bad enough, then it's like a miracle, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of these days, and I've never wore earplugs.
Never?
Never. I cannot play with earplugs. I hate it, and I hate those in-ears monitors.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It just doesn't sound right, you know? When I'm playing, I have to hear my amp.
You got to feel
the air.
The movement.
Move the air.
Right. How many guitars you got now? You got a bunch?
Not as many as like Bonamassa or somebody, you know.
Yeah.
I got like 30 guitars.
Whoa.
That's not very much.
30?
You think that's
from a man who had one through the whole doors. And then you picked up a second one. Oh, I got a 54 or a Les Paul here. Gibson did that cool reissue of your 54, right?
Yeah. Well, they did my other one too.
Oh, wow.
My red one.
Yeah.
About 25 years ago, I picked up a 67 SG, which I still use every night, and they made a model of that. It's a little different. It has the neck from a 61 Junior, you know, that wide flat.
Yeah,
neck.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. Those are all gone, unfortunately. I wish I could. I still have a couple. They're gonna make... next year they're going to make a model of my 67 exactly how it is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's going to be...
It's going to have one of my paintings on it.
That's going to be great.
Yeah.
Do you have all your doors, like memorabilia and stuff, like gold records and stuff?
Oh, man, I wish I'd kept more of that stuff. I got some, but, you know, I was never a collector or a hoarder, you know. So much stuff I wish I would have kept.
Yeah. Especially in the eBay world.
Right. Well, like, you know, I do a lot of charity stuff, so if I had kept that stuff, it would have been great to be able to auction some of that stuff off. Somebody's got that guitar of mine that stole that guitar. I just hope I'm sure whoever it is doesn't realize what it is.
Yeah, right?
You know? Some guy probably, whoever stole it probably sold it for $100.
Yeah. And somebody sanded it.
Probably.
Painted it, you know? I don't want to get caught. They painted with primer. And then it ended up in a, like a punk band in the 80s. Circle Jerks or something was playing it.
They probably smashed it.
Yeah, they smashed it on some guy's head. It's just like a historic guitar. Just gone. Oh, my God. God, I love that, man. Yeah. I can't thank you enough for talking to me.
No problem.
I'm telling you, like I said, man, you played in the greatest L.A. band of all time.
Yeah, and lucky.
You're a rock and roll.
Right place at the right time. That's what you got to do.
Wow. Yeah. But I'm also, I mean, you wrote great songs. Yeah. If the band had no songs, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about you.
That's right, especially the ones I wrote.
That's the bottom line, you know. Yeah. You got to have great songs, and you guys had so many great songs. I was laughing. I was looking at there was like some greatest hits on iTunes or something. I was just laughing. It was just a row of just incredible songs. Any band would take one of those and be touring on that one hit still, you know?
I know.
Well, thanks for talking to me. Social media for you, right?
I do have a guy.
Oh, yeah? What is it?
I have Facebook and the other one, Instagram.
You get on there?
I have a guy that does it for me. I never go on it myself.
Robbie Krieger Art. I love these guys. You guys are like,
I paint as well. So.
Oh, you paint and draw.
That's why they call it art.
Oh, wow. What are you, into oils or what?
So the other one.
Acrylic?
Acrylic.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So what I do a lot is I paint on plexiglass, and then so I'll paint on one side of the plexiglass, and then I'll get another piece, and I'll squish it on there, and you get some great effects by moving around.
Wow.
And then I do regular painting as well, but, I'm no Ronnie Wood, I do some pretty cool stuff. In fact, there's one of them right up there. Can you see it in the back? See the...
right there.
Yeah, it's called...
Oh, wow, that's beautiful.
Light My Fire, it's called.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty much the favorite one. So we make copies of it, and we sell them, and the money goes to different charities.
Oh, that's cool. Who are your charities?
Art for a Cause, it's called. St. Jude's, I do a lot. And I have another charity called The Music Path, where we're trying to get music back in schools.
Oh, that's a must, man. Yeah. Bill Graham was way into that too.
Was he?
He would do like these shows at the Fillmore, and they give all the money to keep music project, classes in school in San Francisco.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's a big deal for him, you know.
Because that's always the first thing they cut out.
Always. The music. Yeah. I always say get rid of the sports, keep the art.
Really?
Yeah, they can play sports at home.
I know.
In the backyard.
No, sports is a big moneymaker for.
I hear you.
College, which is.
But stupid. Sports didn't sell 100 million records.
That's true.
Thanks for doing the show, man. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you. I love you, man. All right, guys. Let's all thank the Whiskey family here.
Yeah, yay, Whiskey.
Yeah. I absolutely love this place.
Amy, let's show a picture of Amy.
Yeah, she's so great.
Come on up, Amy.
Yeah. Come up here. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Let There Be Talk. Keep the candles lit. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and iTunes. And thank you.